are public opinion analysts Lewis Harris and Daniel Yankelovich. First, Mr. Lewis Harris will be interviewed by ABC Capitol Hill correspondent Sam Donaldson and ABC News correspondent Virginia Sherwood.
Mr. Harris, your last poll showed President Nixon with a 28-point lead and gaining, probably because of Vietnam peace talks. What do you show now? Is that trend continuing?
Virginia, we'll have something out tomorrow in the 300 newspapers that carry our the Harris survey, and I can't break that deadline. As a matter of fact, all day today into the late hours tonight, we'll be analyzing the results polling yesterday and today. I would say this, that you've had two rather respectable polls out, the Massachusetts poll and Michigan poll, which show some closing here. I think you had this. Can I just describe in a way what's happened in the campaign? You had, in a sense, I think people forget back in May, Senator McGovern was only 7 points behind President Nixon. And then it jumped 15 points in June. And then it jumped 20 points in July before the Democratic Convention. And then it moved through the 20s up to the peak of 34 points behind as of early September. And that was really the low point for Senator McGovern. Then he started back and got back all the way to, I say all the way, to 25 points behind. And then as the wave of optimism about the Vietnam settlement hit, this was about a week ago now, the Nixon lead did jump up by 3 points. I think if there is no settlement before Election Day, in all likelihood, you're going to see perhaps some kind of return back to what seemed to be a narrowing of the lead. But we'll know more about that definitively before the end of today.
Oh, you're not going to tell me. It does
and we
sound
probably
like
will poll right up maybe till the end of Monday here, too. We're contemplating that.
Well, you're not giving us figures, and I can understand that. It does sound, though, as if you feel there will be a kind of falling back. Will that, the fact that the Vietnam peace talks did not materialize in peace, will there be any kind of backlash at the polls because of that, do you think?
Well, we found an interesting shift, as a matter of fact, right there. We, on the central, what's now become probably the main issue at the end of this campaign, is probably the claim of President Nixon and Dr. Kissinger, the quote in Dr. Kissinger's words, pieces at hand. Counter to that is Senator McGovern's now, I guess, pretty flat-footed charge that, President Nixon has really booted the peace here by not agreeing to the October 31st deadline, which passed this week. And in the process, McGovern is now saying that Nixon perhaps won't make peace at all. Well, we have a measurement on that. We actually went out last Thursday and did a poll on it, and we found by 60% to 21% then that people didn't think the president would change his mind, even if there is no peace settlement after the war. And yet, as of yesterday, I've just looked at and seen received out of our computers, you do find that this has slipped a little bit. That is, it's gone to 58% to 27% that the president won't change his mind. Comparably, you get, it was about 49% to 37% that another charge of Senator McGovern's who could have gotten the same terms 3 years ago, that wasn't so, 49% to 37% as of Thursday. As of today, it's 48% to 40%, so that's that we couldn't have gotten those terms. In other words, you're beginning to get some signs of a softening of belief in the consummation of this Vietnam settlement now.
Well,
as we get down to the wire, and that, I must say, is very reminiscent of 1968.
You've said some very tantalizing things, suggesting that the gap is closing, suggesting that the peace issue may not be as strong for President Nixon as it was a week ago. But are you in any way suggesting that Senator McGovern can make up the difference and win the presidency?
Well, Sam, you've really got, I think, to answer that. You've got to say something else. We've really got two campaigns here. It's a strange kind of election, I think, in every way. As a matter of fact, you go deeper You take the question of alienation, you still got well over 40% of the American people who feel such things as the people with power don't care what happens to you, will take advantage of you. The rich get richer, the poor get poorer. The tax laws are written for the rich and not for the average man. This seems to go on. I mean, this is sort of beneath the surface, the seething. All is not hope and a feeling of euphoria out there. But the two campaigns, I think, against that setting really are one. There's the campaign of Richard Nixon, where, as we look at it now in retrospect, it's really pegged on three major events: the visit to Peking, the visit to Moscow, and the wage price freeze of a year ago last August, on which he receives high marks indeed. I mean, you get 70-75% of the voters who say he's done a good job on that. But with it, he also did something else. He sort of half stole the change issue, which, this seemed to be a year of change in America. And by going, in effect, 180 degrees in the opposite direction from what he'd ever done before, Richard Nixon doesn't stand for the status quo. You then had the economy, you had Vietnam, and neither of which I've ever felt President Nixon could win the election. The question was, would he lose the election on either? And on the economy, you still have, right to this day, 55% who think prices are rising faster than they were. And yet, the country does think, by a plurality of 46-38%, that the country's out of a recession.
I know
that's one campaign. There's another campaign, which is the McGovern campaign.
Well, go ahead. Explain it.
Well, the McGovern campaign has been geared, really, toward these. This is what's come through, at least as far as the public is concerned, that the Nixon administration and the president are too close to big business. This is now believed by 58% of the public, and that's risen some here in the last week, that the president did not do a good job of controlling corruption in the federal government, and that's risen to 43-36%. Not a big margin, but still plurality think that's true. And the final one is that there's too much political spying that went on. That's the Watergate issue. And again, the division on that is very much 42-35%, they agree with that. Now, on those, Senator McGovern has scored. But then you got Vietnam. That's how McGovern was closing the gap until Vietnam came along. Now, if Vietnam began to slip out as a Nixon issue, you'd probably get a surfacing of the big business charges, the Watergate, and the corruption. Now, that's all the Nixon side of it. You've got a McGovern side.
Well, you know,
that's really the problem.
That's a very fascinating explanation of what you see happening as far as attitudes and voter preferences. But you have, as you know, dodged my central question. That is, do you see any chance that Senator McGovern can win this election?
Well, here is Senator McGovern's problem. Consistently now for 6 weeks, without fail, survey after survey, we've probably done about six surveys in that period, we find majorities of over 60% of the voters, over 60% who believe the following. One, that he makes too many mistakes, and therefore this questions the soundness of his judgment. That's 61-38% believe that. Second, that Senator McGovern's tax reform and income redistribution program is too radical. No matter how much he's hedged back on it, they still think it by 62-28%. That's over 60%. Three, that Senator McGovern is too indecisive, and you get a majority of 61% who believe that. And finally, I think the most devastating thing about Senator McGovern's campaign is by 63-26%, you get a big majority who say he doesn't inspire confidence as a president should. So the problem is, as Richard Nixon, in a sense, becomes the issue in these final days, and
two days.
Right. And as this happens, the margin should narrow, but then voters come against this block of lack of confidence in Senator McGovern, and that's the die, I think, on the election.
That die is then that Senator McGovern cannot win. Is that correct?
I've not said that.
You've carefully not said that.
I'm not trying to hedge on it. The reason I haven't said that is that, one, I think in our business, where we measure and analyze what the public's thinking, I think it's arrogant to take for granted the votes of the people before they vote. Secondly, more important than that, is this has been a year not only of surprises, it's been a year of volatility. And I think just as in Michigan, according to the Michigan poll, the Detroit News poll, you had a shift of 9 points in a week. In Massachusetts, there's an even larger shift, 13 points. We have today about 40% of this electorate. Not that it hasn't made up its mind. They think they've made up their mind, but they're not beyond being reached in these final days. And I'd say it's our job as analysts, public opinion analysts, to go out and measure that right up to the wire. And that's the reason I don't want to make a sweeping conclusion.
You have spoken of several states. Do you, in your latest poll, see McGovern taking several states, or do you feel, as the New York Times this morning, that it's a possibly a 50-state sweep by President Nixon?
It's hard to say. We can really only speak with authority about our own surveys, and we don't do them on a state-by-state basis. I'm told that McGovern now has a chance of carrying Massachusetts. Michigan may be reasonably close. You hear the same about Wisconsin. District of Columbia seems to be safely McGovern. Where California will stand in the end, I'm not sure anybody knows at this point. But I think if you call that a possibility of several states, okay. Beyond that, the margin seems to widen, particularly as you get to the smaller states and you get below the Mason-Dixon line.
Well, I hate to be a one-question questioner. Let me try it a different way, because not only have you avoided our central question, but you've ducked it as quickly as anyone. Is there then a possibility, turning my question around, that Senator McGovern could win?
Well, I'd say that while time is running short for him, if President Nixon suddenly changed his mind, I gather yesterday was his last day of campaigning, maybe he said his last day of campaigning ever at a campaign rally. Maybe if the president changed his mind, went out stumping in a different style, sort of like we saw in 1970, slashed out at Senator McGovern personally, this might change.
That's not very likely, though, is it?
Well, I don't know. But, I mean, you asked me, is there a possibility? I think, in a way, maybe the decision depends on the Nixon reaction to these events of the last few days, that does what Senator McGovern does in a strange way. Senator McGovern has really gone all out, flat out, all the way in his own way, and I think the American people have drawn a bead and a judgment about him by now.
Very quickly, you've analyzed the McGovern campaign. Could any other Democrat have defeated Richard Nixon this year, all other things being
equal?
Well,
it's very speculative, Sam, but I would say this, that the best measure of how it might have been, I think, comes when we have a rating scale and we say, how would you rate President Nixon on inspiring confidence in the White House? Excellent, pretty good, only fair or poor, taking the first two as positive and the last two as negative. In the whole time that he has been president and during this campaign, he's never had more than an 11-point positive spread on that element of inspiring confidence. This is fascinating because it does mean to me that if it were Nixon versus Nixon, this election might be 5, 6, 8, 10, at most 11-point difference.
What if it had been Nixon versus Edward Kennedy?
Well, the last one we had on that, I think there was an 8-point margin between the two. But that was at a time when Senator McGovern was only 7 points behind in May. You see, the fact is that Senator McGovern lost ground rather than Richard Nixon making up ground. This is one of the big stories of this campaign. And now, at the very end, when you may have some closing, the burden is really on George McGovern to see if he can close ground, but he's closing from so far back, it's a very difficult job indeed.
Thank you very much for being with us on Issues and Answers, Mr. Harris.
Thank you.
In just a moment, we'll be back with pollster Daniel Yankelovich.
Plastic tape, like a can of paint on a roll. It sticks tight, and look how it shapes. Goes on easily and stays on. It's the neat, groovy way to decorate just about anything. And you don't have to clean up either. Scotch brand plastic tape in 7 brilliant colors. It's like a can of paint on a roll.
The meteoric rise of Melvin Higby Jr., the office boy who said,
"You know, it sure would step up efficiency if everyone had his own dispenser of Scotch brand magic transparency. It goes on invisibly, it won't yellow or curl, and you can even write on it."
"Good thinking, Melvin. Let's do it.
It's high time you had a promotion."
"Thanks, Pop."
And to think he owes it all to Scotch Magic Transparent Tape. Look for the green plan.
Children, a hot lunch. Try Chef Boyardee spaghetti and meatballs. It's the hot lunch kids love.
From Chef Boyardee.
No matter whose steel belted radio commercial you see, there'll probably be a demonstration of superior handling characteristics. They'll tell you how steel belted radials make so great a difference you can actually feel it. Feel how they hug the road on sharp turns and at high speeds. So, with everybody telling you similar things, which brand you buy? Well, only Uniroyal can tell you this. Worldwide, we've been selling steel-belted radials 10 years longer than any other American tire company.
Mr. Yankelovich, as a public opinion analyst, you've conducted polls for New York Times and Time Magazine. Your last poll, I believe, indicated a 26-point spread with President Nixon in the lead.
That's correct.
What do you have that's new? Is that lead diminishing?
Well, it does seem to be diminishing, yes. We're in the middle of talking to people day by day, and we'll finish our interviewing tomorrow. But during the course of the week, we found a steady pattern of diminution.
In that pattern, is it enough to do any good for Senator McGovern, who has trailed 26 points in the last, even if he picks up 3, 4, 5, I know you can't give us the figures. Is the trend strong enough?
No, it doesn't seem to be, no. You're saying the president will be reelected, in your opinion. Well, I don't mind answering that question, but I would, before answering it, like to make the distinction between my own personal opinion, which I'm perfectly willing to give you, and what the polls say. Now, the polls show that as of a certain date, the candidates stand in relationship to one another. Doesn't say anything about how people are going to act once they get into the booth. It doesn't tell you how they're going to resolve their uneasiness and their conflict. So that's where the scientific side ends. But my own personal view is that Mr. Nixon will win, yes.
By how much of a margin? A landslide margin or perhaps a narrow margin?
Well, it depends on how you define the two terms. I'd just as soon not get into the guessing game of what the number will be.
The landslide in American politics usually is 55% or better.
I would think that he would achieve that level.
Under that definition, you would say that it is probable Mr. Nixon will have a landslide victory, in your opinion.
Little landslide.
A little landslide.
Mr. Yankelovich.
I don't think it's a little landslide.
Mr. Yankelovich, you say you find a narrowing of the gap. What are the issues or issue that causes this narrowing?
The narrowing.
Yes,
the
government.
Yes, right. Well, I think it's two things. I think that it's primarily among Democrats. Democrats who have said up to now that they would vote for Mr. Nixon, and some of them are beginning to come back to the fold. And they're doing so partly because of the corruption issue, partly because of nervousness over where this Vietnam thing is or is not going. It's really the two, and it may also be some other issues that we haven't quite been able to pick up.
How about the peace issue? Is there any thing that you've discovered in the last 2 or 3 days on that?
What do you mean?
The fact that the peace that was talked about and the hopes that were up has not materialized. Is there a backlash, do you think? Is the margin decreasing because of that? Is that a specific influence?
Yes, but it's not big. It's not big. The most people believe that Mr. Nixon has done everything he can to achieve peace, and they feel that the situation is very delicate, very difficult, and for the most part, they're not blaming him.
So even if that peace does not come, you're saying that will not make a big difference to the voter?
You mean before the election?
Yes.
That's correct. Most voters don't expect peace to come before the election. They have not, they do not, and therefore it does not make that much of a difference.
Why do you think the Watergate case and the other charges about alleged Republican espionage have not really taken hold?
Well, you know, it isn't that they've had no influence. They've had some influence. They've had influence among Republicans who have not liked what they've heard. It hasn't necessarily changed their vote, but it's disturbed them. It's disturbed a lot of Democrats, made some Democrats come back to the fold. But for the most part, it hasn't had the influence because the other issues like the war, like foreign policy, are so important and so transcendent that this, which seems to be just a little dirty underwear, pales in its significance besides the importance of the other issues.
Does Mr. Nixon rate so high on those other issues on foreign policy in your polls? Do they indicate that he rates so high on foreign policy and trying to end the war that he cannot be caught on those issues?
Well, he could be caught if the scandals were linked directly with him. Most people do not link him personally with these scandals. But in the first part of your question, the answer is yes, he does rank very highly. I think that the foreign policy issue is the issue. That if he does win, and he does win big, it will be mainly because of foreign policy. It'll be interesting to see how people interpret the mandate after the election if he does win. But what comes through loud and clear from our studies is that it's China and Russia and defense and Vietnam, foreign policy, that really makes the difference.
Some observers believe that most voters don't like either one of the candidates. They'd like to vote against both of them, but they are choosing, in their opinion, the lesser of two evils. Have you found that to be the case?
Yes, we have. Yes. The two candidates don't turn people on. There are reservations about both of them. They're not beloved men. They're not popular men. There is that choice. There is that sense of choosing between two alternatives, neither of which really makes people jump up and down with joy.
Well, you've already indicated that you believe personally that Mr. Nixon will win in a small landslide, as you call it. Could another Democrat have changed this? Could another Democrat have won?
I don't think another Democrat could have won. You're anticipating what's going to happen. I think that another Democrat the numbers might have been different. Many of the people who prefer Mr. Wallace, for example, would find it more difficult to vote for Mr. McGovern than for some other Democrats. Many of the Democrats for Nixon, defectors, are people who would find it easier to vote for another Democrat. But I really think that Mr. Nixon's strength on the foreign policy issue was such that no Democrat could have won.
Is that Wallace factor really the difference? It's been pointed out that if Governor Wallace were in the race as a third-party man this year, drawing as much or perhaps a little more as he did in 68, well, the two major party candidates would be very close.
That's correct. I think that's true.
Let me ask a question about the polls and the attacks made on them. Lots of people believe that the polls create a landslide effect for the candidate that they show ahead. Most pollsters say that's baloney. But you're one of the few who testified last month that you think maybe this year there was a landslide effect. Do you still feel that way?
Well, that isn't really what I said. I would join those who say that that it's baloney that there would be a landslide effect created solely by the polls.
What I said was that among the Democrats for Nixon, many of them have never pushed that Republican lever. Many of them find it very difficult to do so. They're in conflict about it. And the idea that there are so many others who are going to do the same thing can have a reinforcing effect on them. It's some information that they're taking into account. But look, as far as this bandwagon effect is concerned, if it were operating, you would expect Mr. McGovern's gap to grow bigger. Instead, it's been narrowing. He's come back from a low. He's done a remarkable job. From the beginning of the campaign, where he was about 19, 20 points behind, he was in real trouble at the end of August, beginning of September. That gap almost doubled. He's come back, way back again, so that the polls have not clearly had that effect.
Do you agree that it was the Eagleton affair that really sent McGovern into a tailspin?
I think it was, a critical factor. Instead of picking up positive momentum, Eagleton caused him to go the other way.
Could I go back a moment? You're talking about, Sam was talking about the possibility of polls influencing the voters into a landslide. What about the opposite effect? We have an anti-government feeling, distrust of government. Couldn't there be a lot of voters out there who will backlash, who will vote against the polls? What about the opposite effect?
I think that's there are several ways in which that could happen. For example, 1948, many people didn't come out to vote for Dewey because they were so sure he was going to win. That's what one of the things Mr. Nixon's been worried about this year, the feeling that people won't come out to vote because they're sure that he's going to win. Can have that effect. A lot of people feel, well, Mr. Nixon doesn't deserve to win by a landslide, so they'll vote against him for that reason. That can happen, yes.
Well, then, do you see this narrowing? You've said a little bit of a landslide. Do you see, then, this narrowing considerably from 26 points, which was your last prediction? Prediction? That's
yeah,
the wrong
right,
word.
Right, that is the wrong word, right. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Thank you. That's all right. How much it's going to narrow, it seems to me almost inconceivable that it would flip-flop. Now, I've indicated that it's gone from 26 points. The other polls have shown also that it's been diminishing. It's moving toward where Mr. McGovern was when he began. And it may go a little bit beyond that. That depends partly on turnout. It depends on many, many factors. But it doesn't look as if it's going to completely close.
Well, you know, we've been talking about the gap in terms of vote margin nationally.
Yes.
Let's talk about it in terms of electoral votes.
Yes.
How many states do you think Senator McGovern might be able to take?
It's difficult. Difficult question to answer. I don't really know. 3, 4, 5? I don't know.
So you're saying that Mr. Nixon will take 45 states, which is the Republican prediction?
Well, what you're saying. I would say that I don't know.
What does this do to the Democratic Party, this type of a landslide defeat, if in fact that's what happens on Tuesday?
Well, again, you say landslide defeat. When Mr. Goldwater lost by what will probably stand as the largest margin of defeat.
Very quickly.
The Goldwater, the Republican Party came right back very, very strongly. I think so.
Thank you very much, Mr. Yankelovich, for being with us today on Issues and Answers.
The American Broadcasting Company has presented Issues and Answers, brought to you by the 3M Company. 3M, people still count here.
Tuesday night, the ABC News election team with Howard.
Lawyers in the newsroom. Lawyers always begin by telling you, don't do it. But I think the First Amendment was valid then, and it is now, and I think it has survived this court, this government, and I'm afraid all of our lives. I hope so.
So say you?
Yes.
I agree. I think that I wish the First Amendment were.
the go?
We thought it went very well.
That's good. The reports referred only that I heard, and I heard only one, referred to Foreman.
Oh, well.
No reference to Haynes.
That's good. I've heard some variances, and I heard also a story which is sort of misleading, saying that Judge McRae said that this hearing would not determine or deal with Ray's guilt or innocence, which might sound like he shut off the exculpatory evidence. He didn't do that.
Oh, that's good.
He hasn't ruled on it yet, and I
think
he's inclined to limit things somewhat, but that's natural. Any judge would try to limit the case.
You can always appeal on that basis if he does.
Right. But the there's no doubt in my mind that he's sympathetic and he's very fair, and Hale was helpful by his approach. And I must say that somehow we got Hale hooked on Weisberg, because he brung you up again.
Why, I wonder?
I don't know, but he started yapping about Fensterwald having represented you, and you had written four or five books on assassinations and so forth. And the judge interrupted him and said, "How's this relevant to anything?"
That's good for the judge.
Yeah.
Incidentally, that's a good reading on the judge.
Yeah, and Bud got up and simply, Bud later on explained that he'd represented you and explained all about the suit and everything, and the judge listened very interestedly to the suit.
That was a very good approach. Was it his idea?
Yeah, yeah. No, Bud was very good today. He handled the thing excellently.
Yeah. Boy, that's encouraging.
Yeah. The judge hasn't ruled on the question of the subpoenas, but actually he did. He came out, the first thing he did was to read an initial ruling, and that ruling declared that it was that we would follow the federal rules of civil procedure. But then after we had argued that as regards to subpoena, those rules were not applicable and that there was Supreme Court authority for it, he said that that was only a tentative ruling and he'd have to read the case. So I think there's a chance we'll win on that too.
Yeah.
At any rate, we did score some points on Percy Foreman and on the state's reluctance to bring Foreman in.
Good.
And,
good.
So, as a matter of fact, the judge himself noted originally, started off by saying it seems somewhat unusual that you would be asking me to rule that I have power to order the state to produce its witness.
That was a very good way to put it.
Yeah. So.
That's all our way, Jim.
Yeah. No, I think the thing went very much our way. We were jubilant, actually.
Yeah.
There will be some curtailment of discovery and so forth, but I got no doubt that we're going to get a fair hearing. And
you're going to get fair discovery?
I think we'll get a fair amount of it.
I don't think that to win the case you need any discovery.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that discovery isn't your legal right and in the national interest,
no,
Jimmy's right.
We're going to try for it. And he asked, for example, he asked me a few questions about discovery. For example, why I wanted the Hugh Stanton file. And the way he approached that was he said Ray had refused to recognize Stanton as his attorney, and he wondered in view of that why we wanted it, whether that we were claiming that he was Ray's attorney and so forth. And I said, no, the reason we want that is because from what we have available on that investigation, it began after Foreman started to negotiate a guilty plea, and that seems rather peculiar to us, and we'd like to study it. And he just took it in, and so, on the whole, seemed to us to be very favorable.
That's very good.
And he's got a good sense of humor, which was indulged in when when Hale started talking about elderly witnesses who couldn't make it.
How old is he?
Well, I would say McRae's in his late 50s or something, and he interrupted to ask Hale what he meant by elderly. Hale said,
older than your honor.
Hale said 60s, and the judge just sort of laughed.
That's great.
So Idaho, I think it went about as good as we can expect it.
That's fine. I'm glad to hear that. I've already mailed the book to Bob.
Good.
I didn't include a bill.
One interesting thing. We got the judge himself informed us of a case of which we were not aware, which apparently changes the standard that is used in judging ineffective assistance of counsel.
Our way?
Yes.
Good.
Well, I think so. That's the implication. In the state of Tennessee, I wasn't familiar with it. It came down. It was a Sixth Circuit decision which came down 3 days after Ray.
Oh.
And it abandoned the Farson and Mockery test. And Hale got up and protested that this was the only circuit that had done that and so forth and so on. So I assume it's got to be our way.
Yeah, yeah.
So
Hale knew about it then.
Yeah, Hale knew about it.
Yeah.
It looks like we'll have even a better legal situation because we won't have to argue Mockery and Farce.
Yeah.
And can get something more with more leeway in it.
That's excellent.
Yeah, yeah. So, all in all, we're quite satisfied.
Yeah. Well, the stuff that you may have learned from Bob can wait till we get together. Unless there's something you think I ought to know now.
Nothing really, except I think I'm very strongly of the opinion after listening to this very long story that it connects up in some way with the stuff Ken Smith and Bud were messing around with a year ago. That seems to me very clear for a number of reasons. Just who's behind it's another question.
Yeah. Well, you see, that makes sense of a setup, too.
Yeah, right.
They took on something that they knew we'd be more willing to bite on. Or some of us would be.
Some of us, yeah.
That also makes sense out of freezing me out of it.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, I think Bob was, he was straightforward in his discussion of it. He gave, in minute detail, everything he remembered.
Yeah.
I was very tired when I was listening to it. And
well, you taped it, you said.
Yeah, about 2.25 hours, I'd say.
Okay, well, when we're together, let's listen to it together, yeah. and I'll dub it at the same time.
Okay. So, anything new on your front since I talked?
Well,
about
a little bit. I think that you ought to read the Ehrlichman story in today's paper, and I think this makes sense out of something that I told you. I thought that I was going to be used in. And I will write you a letter, and I'd like you to keep the envelope and the letter attached so you'll have the postmark on it.
Right.
But you remember, before I read anything, my instinct was that it would have some connection.
Mm-hmm.
After I read it, I said I saw possibilities. And I don't know whether you and Bud agreed with that, but I told you about that on Sunday.
Right.
So I'm just going to recount this history so that, in the memo, so that nobody can say, well, you made it up after the fact.
Right.
And that's why the postmark will be important, because it'll be before it can happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that will, in time, assume some significance.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Now, I spent the whole day getting stuff ready to mail.
Uh-huh.
As a consequence of yesterday.
Uh-huh.
Everything I could find on 7-18-70.
Uh-huh.
And I can't find my copy of the Anderson affidavit.
Well,
and that is important.
I'm not sure.
Huh?
I may have.
If you don't, Bud has to.
No, all the files will be with me. I think I've got all the files.
Okay. Well, then I really need two copies of that. One for me and one to mail.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, as I say, I stayed busy. I hadn't even read the paper. I read that clipping while I was waiting when I went in town this evening. And it struck me right away. It's the motion in court yesterday.
Okay.
I think it might be worth getting a copy of if it's not too long.
All right.
You read the story and decide for yourself. I take it you haven't had a chance to read the paper.
I haven't had a chance to do anything, no.
Yeah.
Right. As a matter of fact, I'm sorry I didn't even manage to get a copy of the paper yesterday when I was in Memphis, and I'm told that home edition of the Press Senator had a very favorable article on me, and I was on the attorneys, but it was apparently...
Wayne will send it to you.
I was told I was described as the brains of the case, or behind the case, or something.
That's quite a compliment to junior counsel.
They're really up in Frederick, but that nobody will know that for a while. But the judge is going to get awfully interested in frame-up after Hale keeps beating on you.
You think
while.
I ought to send him a copy? You know, there's one thing that occurs to me that Bud really should have done at that juncture.
Uh-huh.
And to have said the simple truth. Your Honor, this is a man who has no income. The book is long since dead. He has the only copies that are available. He doesn't advertise them because he's got no means.
Well,
and he has acted as unpaid investigator in this case.
At that point, it wouldn't have been helpful. Bud did what was very helpful. He got
the other stuff in.
He got the other stuff in, and actually he got up. Hale had jumped up about our trying to introduce frame up and the other books in evidence, and then after he'd made a big scene and so forth, Bud just got up and explained what I'd whispered to him, which was that, you know, we just wanted to introduce those for facility of reference, not as evidence, but so that when examining a witness, you could refer to it by page. The judge understood it perfectly, Hale really looked fairly bad about it, I think.
That reminds me, I heard from Larry, and I got some clippings from him from the wire that I haven't had a chance to read yet, but I put them aside to lend to you. And he tells me that one of the stories says the government is going to call writers of books and those who plan books.
Well,
that's George.
Yeah, well, we beat them over the head on that too, because what they want to do is submit affidavits of writers. And
nothing doing.
What we did, we got up and Bud handled it very well. He said, first of all, I had given him some of the suggestion of what to say, but he carried it on very well and said, you know, most of these writers will want to be at the hearing, and there's no need to have subpoena them or submit affidavits. They want to be here. In fact, now I'm sure they'll want to use Mr. McMillan, and the judge says, who's McMillan? And Bud says, well, he's a writer who's been writing a book on the King assassination for 5 years, and it hadn't been published yet. Bud says, I know all of these people, and some of them have asked me when the hearing date would be. I'm sure they'll know from the papers when the hearing date will be, but it shows that they're interested and they probably want to attend, so let's have them here, so I think on the whole...
Yeah, well, of course that question comes up again. It's a very simple thing to say, Your Honor, we can't cross-examine an affidavit. These people are alive.
Well, as a matter of fact, in my... excuse me just a second, I got something in my throat. In my presentation, I pointed out to him that under the federal statutes that if they submit affidavits, then we get the right to propound interrogatories to the person who makes the affidavit.
Yeah.
And that would drag things out a long time.
Yeah. That was good.
Yeah. So, I think on the whole, we were just, you know, we may be over-optimistic, but we sure looked good from our point of view.
That's good.
And the state was just pretty bad, I think. And
well, they can't help it, Jim. They got no choice.
Yeah.
Unless you're a foreman, you can't be a Hale on this case and not look bad.
Yeah.
There's just no alternative.
Yeah.
The case is really that bad a case.
Yeah.
Well, I'll save my yesterday for when we're together.
Okay.
And you're going to be the only person I'm going to talk to about it, and that's understood.
Right. Okay.
And you're going to want to be going up there.
Okay.
I've arranged for that.
All right. Good.
And you will restrict it to the FOI stuff, unless you're asked otherwise.
Right. Okay, now what date will you be up there?
I don't know.
When will you be in here?
I'll be in both Wednesday and Thursday.
Okay. Wednesday morning, I have an appearance in court.
How long will it last?
I don't think it'll last very long. Probably not more than half an hour, 45 minutes.
Well, I have the...
The actual appearance shouldn't be more than 15, but...
You don't know when it'll be called. Yeah. Well, I'm doing the 9:30 TV show. It's only a half hour. And if I left then, it would be 10:30 before I got downtown. So maybe, unless something else turns up, you call me there and I'll wait.
Right.
I'll be with Dave Simon.
Well, it's
you met him, didn't you?
I'm not sure about
didn't
that.
Didn't I introduce you? Yeah, he was here when you were here on Sunday.
Right, right.
Remember I said he directs the show?
Right.
That guy.
It's probably going to be better for you to call my place because it's too uncertain. What I've got is an annulment proceeding. And I just don't know whether there are going to be 10 other cases before me or not.
Well, there's another thing that may interfere with it.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, but let me tell you my Thursday schedule. I have a 9 o'clock dental appointment.
Yeah.
That's only supposed to be last a half hour for what's supposed to be in a semi-annual event with me, what they call a peritip.
Right.
You know what that is?
No.
I think they call it a peritip. I don't know. It goes around the gum line with some.
Oh, right. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
It's because I developed some pyorrhea.
Right.
Years ago, and this isn't. He does it all the time as a precaution
and
as an inquiry after the annual examination, semi-annual examination, which showed nothing.
Yeah.
Now, I've heard from Don Edwards.
Uh-huh.
Did you know that?
You said the other day the meeting didn't come off.
Well, that's right, because he couldn't make it.
Right.
And I told them in a letter that I really would be reluctant to deal with a member of the staff who was unknown to me, and I explained why.
Yeah.
And I sent him the citations from 2569-70 to 44 U.S.C. 2106 and 2107.
Right.
And I told him I thought this was really much more basic than anything he was talking about, that until these requirements were met, any ruling had to be of a fraudulent nature, and any people making such rulings had to be guilty of conspiracy, in my layman's view.
Right.
And I said the other stuff would have to wait until we're face-to-face. And then I told him when I'd be in town, I said, I can, if you'd like me to, just come and sit and wait until you're free and bring stuff with me to work with. So that could be something he might ask me to do. I told him I thought it'd be better if we did it outside of his office.
Right. Okay. Okay, good enough. Well,
and one thing... go ahead.
Yeah, no. I'm just...
One thing occurred to me today, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
The book that... This non-book that we're talking about has a remarkable usefulness to Republicans. Not to Nixon, but to Republicans. Does that suggest anything to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, doing it honestly.
Right.
Because you know the title I planned for it.
Right.
Well, maybe I didn't discuss it with you. I know I did with Sammy.
Right.
Top Secret JFK right. Assassination Transcript.
Right.
With the subtitle, Watergate 1964.
Right.
And I think it's important for people to understand that this kind of thing has nothing to do with party. And I think that serves every interest, because in this case, in the other book, I'm isolating it to Nixon, except for criticism of Democrats, too.
Yeah.
I point out which Democrats covered what.
Right.
Up.
Right.
You know, so my honest writing, without being influenced by anything, is really useful to Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. That's questionable, because...
Well, they can't... No, they can't duck
both
the...
ways.
Well... I thought of this since the idea came to me, which was earlier this afternoon, and I really believe it.
Yeah.
For example, you've got Weicker.
Yeah, right.
You've got Mathias and this whole study of authoritarianism by presidents seizing power.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And you got Irvin sitting on everything.
Yeah. Oh, no, I agree with that, but what I'm saying is that the Republicans on the Warren Commission, they are no better than the Democrats, probably.
That's not the point. That's quite true, but it was a Johnson administration function.
Right. Oh, no, I agree with you.
Really think that it does serve a national interest that way in telling people but they really have to vote for individuals, not for parties.
Right.
And it serves the Republicans' interest in saying, we didn't invent this.
Right.
And Nixon's whole machine was not us.
Right.
He bypassed us because we're different.
Right. Right.
So I really think it has that possibility.
Yeah. Agreed. Okay.
Okay.
Good enough. I'll be back in touch with you.
Now, we may be away a little bit tomorrow. I don't know. But if we will be, it won't be for long.
Yeah.
And I'm sure glad to hear Bud did well.
Yeah.
I really am.
He had a terrible time, actually, Thursday. You know, his meeting with Wallace didn't come off.
Hold on just a second.
Yeah.
There's something I've been forgetting since we've been talking. What was the source from which you sent me the biography?
That's Martindale Hubbell's.
Okay.
Yeah.
His meeting with Wallace didn't come off.
Didn't come off, but he got to Montgomery and found that Wallace was flying to Birmingham.
Oh, my.
And Wallace was supposed to come back to Montgomery, but when he came back, he was too ill. His health is much worse than is publicly known. We got that from several sources.
Yeah.
And when he got back, he couldn't meet, and Bud had just missed his plane or something. Couldn't get another plane out. You know, they only run one in a week or something.
Yeah.
And so he had to rent a car and drive all the way from Montgomery to Memphis on a two-lane road. Took him 7 hours, and he arrived at 11 o'clock last night. Livingston and I had just about given him up for kidnapped or something, and he walked.
Yeah, well, you were wondering if he's going to come in.
Yes.
Well, you know, it serves him right for freezing the wrong people out. He ought to have other people in on these things. He's never accomplished anything by them, but he wants something personal,
yeah.
And something personal he's not going to get.
Yeah.
The only way he can get it is with somebody who can do it for him.
Yeah. Well,
and until he realizes that voluntarily, he's lost. Now, if he'd had somebody with him, somebody could have stayed behind.
Yeah. Well, when he gets down and does his work, he's good. He was damn good today. There's an inconsistency there, but when you keep his nose to the grindstone, why, he can be damn good. And today he...
Well, that lobbyist way of his should really be very effective on something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it would.
And especially in the Southern Court.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the judge is very, very informal, very casual. And
that's good.
I felt very good about the whole thing. So
that's really good.
Yeah. So, okay, good enough.
Bye, Jim.
Yeah, I'll see you soon.
Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Bye.
Now when the American people see that wiretapping and bribery and other types of seduction like that are permitted by a committee to re-elect the president, they begin to fear for themselves. The television people, the newspaper people, labor union people, even people in their private homes say, is nothing sacred? Can anybody be invaded and wiretapped and spied upon this way? And then I think it began to take effect.
Is this sort of thing... if it is in fact true, is it likely to exist in future political campaigns?
I think unless specific steps are taken against it, yes, I think it is. Because it's a certain type of person will do that under any circumstances. Speaking not only in political campaigns, but they'll do it in between political campaigns. I think you're going to have Big Brother looking over your shoulder, not in 1984, but 1972, 3, and 4.
Speaking of future campaigns, so what about 1976? Is it inevitably going to be Senator Edward Kennedy versus Spiro Agnew?
No, I think it's going to be George McGovern and Sergeant Shriver versus maybe John Connally or Spiro Agnew.
Well, let's take the Republicans first then. Is there anyone on the scene? Do you feel, for instance, that Connally could take Agnew inside his own party?
Well, I would doubt it, but I'm not a Republican, and I don't want to speak for them. I think, obviously, Spiro Agnew has a inside track, and that's a prospect that should interest many Americans, the possibility that Spiro Agnew will succeed Richard Nixon, and you'll have 8 years of Spiro Agnew as President of the United States. There's a possibility that really makes your blood run through your veins, doesn't it, and inspires you about America.
Well, there's another possibility, too, and that is one that would not make your blood run too well, and that's that you might lose. Let's assume that does happen. would you feel that Senator Kennedy has done the kinds of things that put him in good shape for a try at the presidency in 1976?
Sure, yes. I think he's in great shape for a try for the presidency in 76 or 80. I think he's campaigning very strongly for our ticket now. He's got tremendous friends in the Democratic Party, probably the most popular person in the Democratic Party. I think he'd have an inside track. Sure, he's a fine person.
Would you encourage him to run?
Sure.
You think he should?
Sure.
Well, what happens to you? I know that you've denied that you have any political base. You have no political ambitions as of now. Do you really plan to become the Bill Miller of the Democratic Party?
No, I don't think I'll ever get to that point, frankly. I wasn't at that point before, and I don't think I'll get to that point now.
There's a good deal of interest already beginning to center on the Democratic National Committee meeting of December 9th. And it is believed that a move will be made to knock off Gene Westwood, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Will you fight to keep her?
Well, you're way ahead of me. You know, I'm running for vice president. You're running for the future, apparently. But I haven't paid any attention to that. I know nothing about it. And I'm sorry to be so ignorant about these internal machinations that you're well versed in, but I'm interested in the presidency of the United States and the vice presidency. I think that's the big issue today in America. What kind of a president are we going to have? Are we going to move America back into the tradition of idealism, for example, that John F. Kennedy was the leader of? Are we going to move in that direction? Or are we going to continue in this crass, spying, secret fund, manipulative politics that we now have with Richard Nixon? I think that's a big issue, not what's going to happen on the December 9th inside the Democratic Party.
You've indicated that that there is something almost immoral about the fact that Richard Nixon is not campaigning more actively.
No, I never did.
Well, what's wrong with you? You said 28 minutes is all he had to devote to New England. Doesn't New England know Richard Nixon pretty well? He doesn't have to go there, does he?
I think what he ought to do is go up there and try to help the people of New England. In many cities in New England, there's 10-15% of people are unemployed. Nothing is being done for those people. Not even any sympathy is being extended to them. He can't know what the real problems are if he's never out there. You don't fly the United States only with a computer or run it. You've got to know what's happening with the people, and the people are not being paid any attention to by this administration. Nobody talks to the people. The only thing they're interested in is power. They're interested in money, that is, people with money, or bombs. I used to say in the campaign, those heard me, bombs or bucks. That's all the places they go. They never go where there's anybody that's unemployed, anybody that's sick. Nothing that involves human beings is of interest to them. That's why Nixon vetoes everything that helps people. He vetoes education, he vetoes health, he vetoes veterans affairs. Why are there 300,000 veterans of Vietnam unemployed in America today?
In the few seconds we have left, you said that you wanted to see those financial lists because you thought that the president had something to hide. That's why he wasn't releasing them. Now that you've seen those lists, have you decided he did not, after all, have anything to hide?
No, I haven't, and we haven't seen them. The most interesting ones are still under lock and key. But why, I ask you, shouldn't the president be the man who takes the lead in disclosing what goes on? Why should he be the covert person hiding in the White House, away from the American people? When he went to New England, he was even afraid to get out of the airplane. It appears, and mixed with the people, you had to have a ticket to shake hands with the President of the United States. Lincoln used to have open house, and anybody could come in there.
Mr. Shriver, thank you very much for being with us today on Issues and Answers. In just a moment, Issues and Answers will return with pollsters Lewis Harris and Daniel Yankelovich.